You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 205 by Rudolf Steiner, titled The Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos, 13 lectures, translated by William Forward. This is Lecture 5, given in Dornach on the 1st of July, 1921. Today I would like to make a kind of excursion from the remarks I made 8 days ago, or more, and then lead on into the continuation of our studies. In our experience of the world, we can see much in ourselves and in the world itself that appears abnormal or pathological, and from a certain point of view, rightly so. But the moment we see the world as abnormal or pathological in an absolute sense, we have not yet understood it. Indeed, we often bar the way to an understanding of the world if we simply stick to evaluations such as healthy and ill, right, wrong, true, false, good, bad, and so on. What from one point of view can appear abnormal or pathological can from another point of view seem fully justified in the wider context of the whole world. I will now give you a concrete example, and you will see what I mean. The incidence of so-called hallucinations, or even visions, is rightly considered pathological. Hallucinations, or figures that appear in human consciousness, and which on closer critical examination do not correspond to any equivalent reality, are pathological when viewed from the perspective of life as we know it, between conception and death. However, in determining that hallucinations are abnormal, and that they certainly do not belong in the course of normal life between birth and death, we have by no means grasped the essence of their nature. Let us set aside any such judgment about hallucinations. Let us look instead at how they appear to the person who is hallucinating. They occur in the form of images, which are more intensely connected to the person's subjective experience, to their inner life, than the usual outer sense impressions. An hallucination is inwardly experienced more intensely than a sense impression. Moreover, a sense impression can be subjected to clear critical thinking. The person having an hallucination will avoid subjecting the hallucination to clear critical scrutiny, preferring to live in the hovering, weaving imagery. What is this experience the person is living through? It cannot be understood if one is only familiar with what appears to ordinary human consciousness between birth and death. The content of an hallucination will invariably appear unjustified to such a consciousness. An hallucination must be seen from a completely different point of view and can then reveal its true nature. This point of view is attained when in the course of inner development toward knowledge of the higher worlds, one is able to understand one's own living and weaving passage between death and a new birth, and in particular, when one's own being is decades away from approaching conception and birth. When we have acquired the faculty of feeling our way into what we all normally go through, on approaching birth or conception, we are feeling our way into the true nature of what is experienced as abnormal, as an hallucination, in life between birth and death. Just as here in our life between birth and death we are surrounded by the world of color, where we can sense every breath of air and so on. In other words, what we consider normal experience between birth and death, in passing between death and birth, the experience of our being, of soul and spirit, would be in an element that is completely identical with what we would consider an hallucination. We are born out of the element of hallucination, and particularly so in respect of our physicality. What occurs in an hallucination is, as it were, wafted through the world that underlies our own soul, and we emerge from this element at the moment of birth, an element that can seem abnormal in our soul life thereafter. So, what is an hallucination in ordinary consciousness? Now, when we have gone through life between death and the new birth, and have entered physical existence through conception and birth, certain spiritual beings from those higher hierarchies we have become familiar with will have had an intuition, and our physical body is the result of this intuition. In short, certain beings have intuitions. The result of these intuitions is the human physical body, which can only come into existence by means of the soul permeating it on emerging from the element of hallucinations. What happens when hallucinations are experienced pathologically in normal consciousness? I can really only represent this to you in the form of an image. But this is natural, since hallucinations are, after all, images. It is therefore obvious that one will not get very far with abstract concepts. One has to resort to representing hallucinations in picture form. Now, try to imagine the following. Our physical bodies, as I recently pointed out, consist only minimally of clearly defined contours. They are mostly watery, partly airy, and so on. This physical body has a certain consistency, a certain density. When this natural density is rendered unnatural, when its natural consistency is interrupted, try to imagine it symbolically as being compressed in its elasticity. Then the original hallucinatory element out of which it was born is squeezed out like water out of a sponge. The origin of an hallucinatory experience is nothing other than the original element of the physical body out of which it was born and shaped, being squeezed out of it. The pathology that comes to expression in hallucinatory experiences in consciousness always indicates ill health in the physical body, that spiritually squeezes itself out, as it were. This fact shows us that, in one sense, our thinking really is what materialism says it is. Our physical body really is a copy of what pre-existed us in the spiritual worlds before our birth or conception. It is a copy. The thinking that appears to us in everyday consciousness, on which we pride ourselves more than anything, is indeed completely bound to our physical body, as materialists point out with some justification. The fact is that the thinking faculty that we have been using since the origins of modern scientific thinking in the 15th century ceases to function when the physical body does. What you will often find in the Catholic philosophy commonly accepted today, though not what people believed in previous centuries, is the idea that the abstract intellectual working of the soul continues after death. This is wrong. It is simply not true. The type of thinking that characterizes the cultural life of our times is indeed bound to the physical body. The quality of thinking that survives the death of the physical body will only be found in the next higher stages of inner development, in imagination, in imaginative thought processes. You might then think that anyone who does not have these is deprived of immortality. The issue has to be viewed in a different way. To say one has no imaginative thought processes is meaningless. You could say, quote, "I have no imaginative thought processes in my everyday consciousness. I cannot introduce them into the way I think every day," close quote. But we are constantly forming imaginative pictures within us. Imaginations are constantly taking shape in us, but are then utilized in organic life processes. They turn into the forces which we use to renew our bodily organism. Our materialistic philosophy and our materialistic natural science take the view that our depleted organs are revitalized in some way when we are asleep, but do not take much trouble to determine exactly how that happens. What actually happens is that it is precisely in our day-waking consciousness that we are constantly developing imaginations, even when we are working with our everyday intellectual consciousness. And these imaginations are then, in a sense, digested in our soul life, where they enable us to rebuild our bodies. It is because these imaginations are rebuilding our bodies that we are not aware of them separately in our everyday consciousness. Developing higher faculties of knowledge relies on us partially withdrawing, from an external point of view, from this work of rebuilding our physical bodies and drawing up into consciousness what is otherwise bubbling and simmering below. That is the reason why spiritual science is necessary to attain higher knowledge. Since this process is not sustainable for any length of time without undermining the health of our organism. So in ordinary life we do form imaginations, but these are then digested during our time between birth and death. We could go on to say that there is an unconscious process going on in ordinary life which is in fact hallucinating, and would be recognized as such if we became conscious of it. Hallucinating is undoubtedly a primitive response in our existence. It should not, however, appear in our consciousness inappropriately. Hallucination, as it normally manifests, should really be confined to our subconsciousness. When the body, as it were, squeezes out its primal substance, it can happen that this primal substance becomes embodied in our normal consciousness, and then hallucinations appear. Hallucination simply means that our body sends up into our conscious mind what it would normally use for digestion, growth, and other such processes. This in turn relates to what I have often explained in connection with the illusions people have about certain mystics. It is as if one were devaluing their essential character by pointing out the underlying phenomena. I said, take for example the hallucinations that have a remarkably beautiful poetic character, like those described by figures such as Mechtilde von Magdeburg or Saint Teresa. They are certainly beautiful, but what are they in reality? Anyone who has a true understanding of these phenomena will find that they are hallucinations, squeezed out of the organs within the whole organism of the person having them. They are primal substance. A truthful description of them will, on occasion, include processes very similar to digestion in the cases of Mechtilde von Magdeburg or Saint Teresa, however beautiful the mystic poetry may be that streams from their consciousness. One need not actually say that some of the fruits of historical mysticism are thus deprived of their flavor. The sensual delight that some people experience when they turn their thoughts to mysticism, or when they wish to have mystical experiences themselves, can, however, be traced back to its true origin in this way. A great deal of mystical experience is, in fact, simply inner sensual delight, which can appear in our consciousness as poetic beauty. The only thing that is destroyed by this consideration is prejudice or an illusion. If we are set on penetrating through to an understanding of the reality of our inner life, we will have to be prepared to find not the wonderful descriptions of such mystics, but the products of their liver, lungs, and other organs out of the cosmos, the hallucinating of the cosmos. In essence, it is not so much removing the flavor of mysticism as opening a doorway toward a higher understanding if we are able to show how liver is formed by the hallucinating of the cosmos, how it is in a way the transformed result of a condensation of the spirit and its hallucinating. We can thus gain an insight into the nature of our physical body and into its relationship with the entire cosmos. Whenever we try to explain the truth in detail, there will be very clever contemporaries who will raise their objections, and one such might be, quote, "What are you saying? That the human form takes shape out of the cosmos? But we know human beings are born out of the mother's body. We know how they look in embryonic form and so on," close quote. Now there is a fundamentally wrong idea at the root of such an objection, which we shall have to deal with, despite the fact that we have done so before. If we look at the variety of forms in the natural world around us, we will find the greatest diversity. We might name them crystals. We will also find other forms emerging from any given inner configuration of, let's say, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, or sulfur. We know that when carbon and oxygen combine to form CO2, a gas emerges that has a certain weight. When carbon combines with nitrogen, the result is cyanide gas, and so on. The materials arising can always be analyzed by a chemist, but do not always have an outer crystalline form. They do, however, have an inner configuration. This inner configuration has even been pointed out recently by means of structural formula familiar to contemporary science. This has, however, always been subject to certain preconditions, namely, that the molecules, as they are termed, always become increasingly complex the further we progress from inorganic to organic matter. Moreover, it is said that the organic molecule, the cell molecule, consists of carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, and sulfur. They combine in one form or another. It is further stated that the way they combine is very complex. It is regarded as an ideal within natural science to discover just how these individual atoms can combine in such complex organic molecules. Scientists admit that it will take a long time to find out how organic matter is built up, atom by atom, into the living molecule. The secret, however, is this. The more an aggregation of matter is organic, the less its individual elements are combined by chemical processes, the more the constituent parts are whirled about chaotically. Even an ordinary protein molecule, let us say, in a nerve substance or in the substance of blood, are essentially inwardly amorphous forms rather than complex molecules. On the contrary, they are composed of inorganic matter that has been torn apart inwardly, that has rid itself of the forces of crystallization, the very forces that hold the molecules together, that connect one atom to another. This already holds true of any ordinary organic molecule, and most of all of the molecules of the embryo in the protein of the seed. If I illustrate this schematically, with the organism here and the seed there, that is the beginnings of the embryo, then the seed is the most chaotic combination of material components imaginable. This seed has emancipated itself from any crystallizing force, any chemical force at work in the mineral world, etc. An absolute chaos has appeared at one point, which can only be held together by the other organism. The fact that this chaotic protein appears here is what enables the entire cosmos to work on the protein, so that in fact it receives the imprint of forces from the entire universe. The ovum, meanwhile, contains the forces which give form to the etheric body and the astral body before fertilization has taken place. Once this has happened, it also embodies the physical form and the vessel or sheath for the eye, capital. Here we have the situation before fertilization, and this is a purely cosmic image, an image from out of the cosmos, because the protein emancipates itself from all earthly forces and thus can be determined by what lies beyond the earth. The earthly substance within the ovum truly is devoted to the forces of the cosmos. These create their own image within the ovum. Certain forms of egg in the animal kingdom, birds, for example, enable us to see something very important. This is naturally not evident in higher animals nor in human beings, but we can find a reflection of the cosmos in the shape of a hen's egg. An egg is, in fact, a genuine image of the cosmos. The cosmic forces work into the dedicated protein that has emancipated itself from its earthly origins. An egg really does bear the imprint of the cosmos, and philosophers need not speculate about the three dimensions, since the riddles of the world are revealed openly everywhere, if one knows where to look. The shape of a hen's egg is a proof of the fact that one axis of the world is longer than the two others, and the outer contours of a hen's egg, the eggshell, are a true image of our space. As an aside to mathematicians, it will be necessary for our mathematicians to examine the relationship between Lobachevsky's geometry or Riemann's definition of space and the form of a hen's egg. There is a great deal to be learned from this. Problems actually need to be addressed correctly. You see, when we contemplate the receptive and adaptable protein, we are able to study how the cosmos works into it and can elucidate in detail how the cosmos has determined it. The caution does have to be added, however, that we cannot yet go very far with this, since if people of our time were able to pursue this in detail, the resultant knowledge could be abused in the most appalling way, given the extraordinary moral low point that has been reached by the civilized population of the world. We have now observed how our body produces these mental images. It squeezes out of itself the world of hallucination, from which it originated. Apart from our physical bodies, we also carry a soul within us as part of our being. We will do best to leave this soul aside for the moment and focus on our spiritual aspect. Just as during our life between birth and death we can walk around and seeing ourselves from outside we can say, quote, "We wear our physical bodies like a garment," close quote. So in the life between death and a new life, we can say that we have a spiritual existence. That corresponds to what we can observe inwardly, and it means that there is no essential difference between what we can say about our bodies between birth and death, on the one hand, and our spiritual beings between death and rebirth, on the other. We have grown accustomed here to speak of the spirit as the fundamental essence of everything. This is, however, an illusory way of putting it. We should rather speak of the spirit as what belongs to us between death and a new birth, just as our bodies belong to us here between birth and death, in the sense that we are embodied here, so between death and the new birth we are spiritualized. Moreover, this spiritual essence does not cease to be when we take on our bodies, which have emerged from the hallucinating of the cosmos, but continues to work on in us. Imagine the moment of conception, or perhaps rather a moment between conception and birth. It is not so important to focus on this particular moment, but imagine any point where we pass out of the spiritual world into the physical, and you will say to yourself, from this moment on, our physical existence integrates with our soul and spiritual dimensions. Soul and spirit undergo a metamorphosis into our physical nature. Now, the powers that we had acquired between death and a new birth do not cease to work at this moment of stepping into physical existence, but continue to have their effect in a very particular way. I shall illustrate it schematically like this, and there's a picture. Now take the strength from your last death that works on in you in the spiritual world through to the moment, I shall call it birth, of your birth in your current life. The forces of your physical and etheric bodies will continue their work there. Then there would be a new death. But this power which belongs to us leading up to the new birth continues to work on in us, and yet, in another sense, does not. Its true being has been poured into our bodily nature, filling it with spirit. What remains of this power and continues on, as it were, in the same direction are only images, a picture of existence. Between birth and death, then, there lives on in us in the form of an image what we possessed between death and the new birth. This image is the power of our intellect. Our intellect has no reality between birth and death, but is, in fact, an image of our existence between death and a new birth. This perspective sheds light both on philosophical and cultural riddles. The whole configuration of our contemporary culture, which is dependent on the intellect, becomes clear to us when we know that it is a culture of images, a culture that has not been created out of any reality, but is an image. An image, it has to be said, now of spiritual reality. Today's culture is an abstract one. Materialism is, after all, a culture of abstraction. One can think the finest thoughts once their origin is denied, and one becomes a materialist. Materialistic thoughts were fundamentally quite penetrating, though they did follow an erroneous course. What is at work there is an image of a world, not a world in itself. This concept is challenging, but do make the effort to grasp it. The only easy part will be to imagine images in space. When you are standing in front of a mirror, you will not attribute any reality to the image that appears to you. It is you who are real, not the image. What is taking place here in space is also happening as a reality in our time. The mirror image is what we experience as our intellect, an image that reflects back in time to our previous existence. Our physical bodies contain a reflective surface, which has the capacity to reflect back in time, and the image that appears in the reflection is that of our pre-earthly existence. The complication arises when our experience of self, our sense impressions, is constantly thrown into this intellectual image. Sense impressions mingle with it. That is why we do not notice that it is, in fact, a reflection. We live in the present. If, as a result of doing the exercises, as described in my title, Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, you reach the point where you can really throw out your sense impressions and live entirely in this image existence, you will actually penetrate through into pre-birth existence, into life before birth. That is when you will experience pre-existence as a fact. The reflected image of pre-existence is, after all, within us. What we have to do is to see through it, and then we will be able to see into pre-existence itself. Everyone is capable of this in principle, unless they succumb to the other phenomenon which occurs when sense impressions are switched off, namely, falling into a deep and healthy sleep. That is true for most people. We exclude all sense impressions, but are then no longer capable of thinking. If, however, you really are able to shut out your sense impressions and retain a lively thinking capacity, then you will find yourself no longer looking into space, but back through the time you spent between your last death and rebirth. This is, initially, very indistinct. But you are aware that the world you are looking into is the world between your last death and the most recent birth. The truth, a true perspective of all this, depends entirely on our ability not to fall asleep when sense impressions are suppressed, and to keep our thinking as lively as it otherwise is with the help of our sense impressions when we are in possession of our senses. Once we are able to see through our nature in this way and into our life before birth, continuing to do our inner exercises, of course, then distinct contours will appear in our spiritual world. Our spiritual surroundings will become apparent to us. That is when our situation turns into its opposite. Here we live within the physical world. We do not squeeze its hallucinations out of our physical body, but lift ourselves out of our bodies and transplant ourselves into our pre-birth existence, and there fill ourselves with spiritual reality. We dive into the world, which is awash with hallucinations. And in perceiving our surroundings, it is not hallucinations that we perceive, but imaginations. The moment we raise ourselves to spiritual awareness, we perceive imaginations. It is, of course, loutish, lacking in common decency, I would say. If someone claiming to be a scientist today constantly counters anthroposophy with the objection, quote, "That's all very well, but what anthroposophy has to offer could itself simply be hallucination. There is no way of distinguishing it from hallucinations," close quote. Such people should try really engaging with the research methods used in spiritual science, and they would then find that it is just by following them that clear and precise distinctions can be drawn between hallucinations and imagination. And what is the distinction? Well, I have pointed out that on the one hand we are clothed with a physical body between life and death, and on the other with a spiritual body between death and a new birth. Our soul is the mediator between the two. Spiritual experience is drawn into our physical body through our life of soul. What we experience by means of our physical bodies is likewise carried by our soul through death and into the spiritual world. Our soul is the mediator between body and spirit. When our physical body experiences awareness, it produces hallucinations. In other words, it brings hallucinations into our consciousness. When our spirit is consciously active as a spirit, imaginations are experienced. And when it is our soul experiencing as a soul and as the mediator between the two, then it neither experiences inappropriate hallucinations squeezed out of the body, nor does it progress directly to experience of spiritual realities, but lives in a less clearly defined middle sphere, the realm of fantasy. The conclusion is that if our body is conscious, its task between birth and death is not normally to be conscious, but it, nevertheless, has a certain consciousness of its own. If it still breaks through to awareness inappropriately, abnormally, then hallucinations result. If our spirit comes to full consciousness by genuinely releasing itself from our body and experiencing realities, then it has imaginations. Our soul is the mediator between hallucinations and imaginations in the less clearly defined realm of fantasy. When our body has a conscious experience as a body, hallucinations. When our body has a conscious experience as a soul, fantasy. When our spirit has a conscious experience as a spirit, imaginations. In describing processes such as these, we are describing real processes. In our intellectual thinking, we only have an image of our soul life in our pre-birthly existence, that is, the image of a life steeped in imaginations, which emerges from an hallucinatory state. Our intellectual life is, however, not real. We ourselves are not real when we engage in thinking, but turn ourselves into an image when we think. We could not otherwise be free. Human freedom is founded on the fact that our thinking is not real when it becomes pure thinking. A mirror image cannot be a cause, in quotes. When you are facing any mirror image, something which is nothing more than an image, and you then act on it, it is not the image which determines the action. Once your thinking is a reality, there is no freedom. When your thinking is an image, your life between birth and death is a school of freedom, because thinking itself cannot determine anything. A life lived in freedom must be a life without determination. Living in the realm of fantasy, on the other hand, is not completely free. It is partly real, as a form of living in one's thoughts. The free life that we bear within is not a real one in terms of our thinking activity. On the other hand, when we can engage in pure thinking and can then develop the willpower to accomplish a free deed out of this pure thinking, we have made a start with experiencing reality. Where we are able to endow our pure thinking with reality out of our own substance, a free deed can take place. That is what I intended to explain purely philosophically in my book titled The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity in 1893, by way of preparation for later work. The end of Lecture 5.